aunt, the other grandmother who migrated from Utsang, she migrated because of the Chinese occupation in Tibet. There are a lot of scholars who have also quoted about how women, when migrating, were pregnant. They have had cases of abortions while migrating. They had to have children with them. A lot of the spaces, literary spaces, writing spaces, do not have a lot of Tibetans, do not have a lot of people from the Himalayan region. There might be one or two, but that is it. Are you a Tibetan? Are you a Sherpa? Who are you? Right? So these questions also becomes really important, because that's also an important part of how you then perceive the world around you. One of the challenges, even when, again, to connect it with what Pomelo does, is sometimes the onus then becomes on you. Yep. Like, why I don't know about mixed heritage? Because the Tibetan identity, this is something that I talk in my MPhil research, is also because it's also shaped by being a Buddhist.
Indeed.
So what happens if a Tibetan Muslim identifies with the movement? They want to be part of the movement. Yep. Because they identify with the Tibetan culture more than maybe their Muslim culture.
Indeed.
I would rather like to make more efforts in like other Tibetans of different kinds, right? To be actively part of the Tibetan movement. I hope they continue their struggle, because that's the only way forward. And for the larger vision for Tibet, I really hope there is a country that we can call our own someday.
Unsilenced Voices of Young Tibetans is a podcast presented by the Foundation for Nonviolent Alternatives, where young Tibetans share their personal stories, experiences, opinions, and journey in exile.
Jashi Dilek, namaste, and welcome to FNVA's podcast, Unsilenced Voices of Young Tibetans. Today we have with us a Tibetan woman who has been the voice of her own community through her research work on the fields of gender, migration, and minority rights. She is also the co-founder and editor of the e-magazine, The Pomelo, Exploring Himalayan Voices, which I myself have been able to go through. So welcome to our show, Nansi Chapala.
Thank you.
So, Nansi, could you share with us your journey into this field of research that focuses on gender, migration, and minority rights? And what initially sparked your interest in these areas? Like, how does your Tibetan identity influence you when you do such research?
I think so. That's a lovely question to begin the podcast with. And I feel, to give a little context to the viewers and the listeners, so I come from a mixed heritage background, which means my grandfather was part of the Chushi Gwandruk, which was a Tibetan resistance or a Tibetan guerrilla group that has been termed by scholars. And then he had migrated in the 1958 to 59, between that, to India. And on my paternal side, I have Sherpa heritage. With this mixed heritage of having migration histories from both Tibet and Nepal to India, finally settling in Darjeeling, I was able to understand how migration becomes a really important part of my identity, and how migration in all forms, especially in the Himalayan region, is really crucial. And it was also with the scholarly engagements that I was able to make sense of what was happening, like why migration happens, why is it important? And also question of gender becomes really important, because both of my grandmothers, they also migrated. One was who migrated due to economic reasons from Nepal, and the other grandmother who migrated from Utsang, she migrated because of the Chinese occupation in Tibet. So these different types of migration, especially for a woman who was traveling independently, also added a lot of context. Like, how would it be different for a man to migrate versus a woman to migrate? So these questions of gender, class, education, and also the regions that they were migrating from, I think so these shaped my ideas of why gender and migration really became important to me to engage with as a scholar and as a researcher. And I feel minority rights became a really important question, because in India, you are a racial minority, you are an ethnic minority. So I feel my positionality as a woman with histories of migration from both my paternal and maternal sides, as well as me being a minority in this country, made me think of how gender, migration, minority rights are interlinked, they intersect, and is also crucial for not me, but for a lot of women who are there, and due to which I, like, my research then focuses on these larger themes.
So two interesting things that came up from this was, like, you said about Chushi Khandro, like, what do you feel is their relevance when it comes to Tibetan current history, you know, and the current form of freedom movement that we are going through? That would be one. And the other thing is, very interesting how you pointed out that the migration of Tibetan women sort of differs from the migration that Tibetan men had to carry out. I mean, this is the first time I myself am hearing such things, because the other aspect that I sort of heard or read about is like Jamyang Nubu. He came out with this argument of Tibetan woman heroes, you know, because we sort of till now have been seeing that all the heroes, all the resistant movements are men, but there were also women. So this is something interesting. And could you expound more on these two?
Currently, I'm also doing a research. I'm writing a research paper called Mapping My Grandmother's Footprints, Exploring Gendered Migration in the Eastern Himalayas, where I'm actually tracing my grandmother's histories when they migrated, but also looking at other women who migrated, who were from the Sherpa community or who were from Himalayan ethnic communities, who migrated from Nepal due to economic reasons and also from Tibet due to forced migration. And I feel there is a stark difference in how women migrate. I think so. There are a lot of scholars who have also quoted about how women, when migrating, were pregnant. They have had cases of abortions while migrating. They had to have children with them. And the responsibility and the onus somehow falls on the woman itself to protect the children. I'm not denying that the father would not be involved, but a lot of the times the father is not present. Then it's on the mother, a pregnant mother, a mother who is also biologically, I'm not sure, in a weaker sense in that way, would then have to migrate. So these questions of this, plus as well as cases of sexual violence that might have happened during the course of migration, we don't ask that question. I'm not sure if I've come across sexual violence during the process of migration. I'm not sure if the women are comfortable enough to share, but I'm sure these questions would have been happened if there, because I'm sure this instance would have happened, if at all, on how women generally experience, because these experiences then shape, as well as what happens post-migration, right? How do we resettle in a new country? Like for my grandmother, if I can speak from a very personal experience, she had to go to her relative's home. And the relative's home, as a woman, it's not a safe space, yeah. Right? To conflate questions of home as a safe space would be, again, a very generic observation. Mm-hmm. But it's also very crucial with the current movement and the knowledge that we've had, that these are not necessarily safe spaces. Then women having to go to be, again, helpers, to go, a lot of the women I interviewed then would go to HMI. Like there's a Himalayan Mountaineering Institute where they would carry load to help the mountaineers, climbers, to do a lot of those work. As well as we've seen instances how women also have played a huge role in the road construction in Shimla, in Uttarakhand. Yes, in Manali as well. So these questions then would have had a very gendered connotation. And I think so these questions and these conversations are emerging.
Very interesting, because like I remember even my father, like he said he was born in the border. So I did not understand in that level which you spoke. And certainly I believe like women definitely during that time must have gone through a lot. And you exploring on these themes are very much needed to understand the holistic picture of what really happened. You know, what we have we as Tibetans have said have happened. It's true, it has happened. But there are other aspects which still have not been covered and needs to be covered. And what you are doing, and even your friends at Pomala, I believe you are doing the same thing through that level. It's very encouraging. So on that note, like two things. Another thing, you bought the Himalayan Mountaineering Institute. So that was initiated by Tenzin Norgay Sherpa, if I'm not wrong, or what's the history behind it?
I'm not sure if I'm like completely aware of the history. I think so it was established by Padmaja Naidu after independence of India.
Okay.
With the help of Tenzin Norgay, but yes.
Okay. So on that note, like, could you share us more about what Pomelo does? Because I've been going through their website and, you know, things that captured me is you have been capturing the oral history of the Himalayan people, which is very much needed because our older generation, they were not given the sort of education that we were able to receive, because for them, the basic drivers of sustaining life, they sacrificed everything for their next generation, their children, to attain such education. We are the proof of that. So what do you think they have been telling you, and through Pomela, what have you all been doing?
So the Pomelo was actually envisioned by my sister, who started it first, and then my other cousin, who is also a Tibetan Muslim, she then wanted to take it forward. So it was the three of us who initially started to document and to amplify Himalayan voices. Voices that might not particularly find a lot of space. So this would also be because in India, so because I grew up, I was born and raised in India, a lot of the spaces, literary spaces, writing spaces, do not have a lot of Tibetans, do not have a lot of people from the Himalayan region. There might be one or two, but that is it. But a large number of women are not constitutive of that. So we wanted an organization, a collective that's mostly based around women and other gender minorities, at the same time looking at issues that the Himalayan people that deal with, right? Because the way we experience gender, the way we experience religion is very different from the rest of the India. And even in the continent, it's very different how we experience certain things. So that was the main goal. And our oral archive project, In Her Footsteps, started with this whole idea about how our grandmothers, our momolas, or our gogas, wouldn't be there in the next 2-3 decades. Their stories are lost. Their experiences will be lost. There is only certain extent to which a researcher as an individual can go about documenting the stories. But then again, they wouldn't put it publicly or wouldn't be publicly accessible to everyone. So we are trying to just record, speak to them about migration. And we are also targeting women who are 60 above. So that it's an older group. We know that they were born at a certain time, historical, political time in Tibet or in Nepal. And we are also trying to now expand it to, say, Bhutanese women who traveled or who migrated to the other parts of Himalayas, or, say, the Ladakhi women. So we haven't had the chance to explore the Western Himalayas so far. Till now, it's the Eastern Himalayas. That, too, it has been around the Darjeeling-Kalimpong region so far.
Definitely, I believe that you must also work on that, like moving from the Eastern to the Western Himalayas, because you have the strong Ladakhi community and their journey to the Himalaya and Tibet to a larger extent is very much connected. So kudos to all of you, and I wish you well. And on top of this, Nausila, you initially in your first question, you brought up the theme of identity. So growing up as a Tibetan with mixed heritage, you know, one finds it difficult navigating such nuanced identities. See, even myself, I'm a Tibetan. My parents were Tibetan. But I was born and brought up in India. I grew up in an Indian community. So even then, I faced some identity issues. So I certainly would believe that you might have gone through the same. So what were your challenges and how did you try to overcome and were able to overcome them?
I think so. One foremost challenge of being from a mixed heritage is the language, I feel. Because as a young kid growing up, the whole concept of the whole word in itself, mixed heritage, is not a very commonly South Asian term that we use. It's a very Western or, say, an American term that has been imported. And it's a language that I have used and learned from them, right? So having that language to actually understand your positionality in a certain community, it's really very difficult. And especially when we think of identity and the whole question of identity in these neoliberal times, it's either you choose one camp or the other. You have to fit in certain boxes. But what if you don't fit in the box? It's then with these kind of languages or with other people's engagement with mixed heritage identities or, say, intercaste identities, interreligious identities, with the scholars and researchers working in India, it really helped me to look at, okay, so one of the challenges would be then identifying. Where do you identify? Are you a Tibetan? Are you a Sherpa? Who are you? Right? So these questions also becomes really important because that's also an important part of how you then perceive the world around you, the question of identity in itself. And then by having these languages or scholarly engagements also allowed me to critically think about, okay, how do I then challenge these boxes of certain rigid identities? Okay, I don't fit in both of these boxes and my perspective is shaped by both. My perspective is not shaped just by my Tibetan heritage or the history of forced migration, but also shaped by economic migration or by my paternal side. So having these mixed perspective, I thought you start becoming comfortable in that, I think. One is you start resisting your identities, like why does it have to happen, right? When people are born with like because there's a general skepticism Indeed. Even within communities. Yep. And I think so it's been clearly noted, I think, so that any community, they want people marry their own community Indeed. Members. So when you end up marrying someone, but just the plus point, I would like also like to highlight that might be different for other mixed heritage Tibetans. Unlike me, it's because my father was a Buddhist, he was also from a Himalayan community, it was easier, similar because of the similar cultural background, but still those were challenges.
Like you brought up the thing of mixed heritage. Mm-hmm. It is something I believe the Tibetan government tried to do. Like I believe, if I'm not wrong, it was 2014. Mm-hmm. They came up with this project, and currently I think it's shelved. I don't know why it got shelved. Mm-hmm. So what is your take on that? Like,
so I didn't know about this group early on, so you chaired it, I went, and I knew the few people who were there, as in I had been following their activism journey within the Tibetan freedom movement, because they had been writing a lot of things, articles I was reading and following up with them, but then I didn't know group existed, also maybe because it's such a small, it's how do you reach out? I think so, one of the challenges even when, again to connect it with what Pomelo does is, sometimes the onus then becomes on you. Yep. Like why I don't know about mixed heritage. Mm. The onus becomes on the individual rather than the group that's actually trying to broaden. So I really feel that onus for individual people to reach out to an organization.
I've come across your article, which you have written for Feminism in India, like title as, I mean, interesting article, like what does it mean to be a Tibetan outside Tibet? Like here you mentioned how the Tibetan diasporic community and the Free Tibet or Tibet Freedom Movement were not inclusive of mixed heritage children. You know, during that time, I think it might have changed. Your perspective might have changed. But what are the specific challenges or barriers that mixed heritage Tibetans face within their community? And how does such a lack of inclusivity, you know, by us Tibetans, the mainstream Tibetans, impact their sense of identity and belonging? And on top of this, like, what do you think we Tibetans, even the Tibetan government in exile, the larger Tibetan community led by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, can do to, you know, bring more awareness and, you know, our Tibetan goal is of oneness. You know, that's what His Holiness says. So how do you think we can achieve? Because you're someone who's gone through this. So I think your message and your thoughts would definitely echo and do a lot of good in this, I believe.
It's an interesting question. And for me to answer this, I think when it was written in 2020, and I feel I had a lot of angst, as well as my co-author, like my cousin sister, Tasneem. So she is a Tibetan Muslim. And what we, again, to contextualize, because we are both from the Eastern Himalayas.
Indeed.
The Tibetan settlement in Darjeeling is a scattered settlement, right? So having this context where Tibetans are spread out throughout the town and the region, it's not in one location for... So what eventually happened, what we felt at that time was we weren't being part of the freedom movement, the activism or the Tibetan circles in our age, at our age, the 18 to 25 age group, right? And maybe it's not that. We aren't putting the onus on them. Yep. However, we are saying, maybe that's an extra effort that we can put to have other Tibetans also, different types of Tibetans be a part of it. Because the Tibetan identity, this is something that I talk in my MPhil research, is also because it's also shaped by being a Buddhist.
Indeed.
So what happens if a Tibetan Muslim identifies with the movement? They want to be part of the movement.
Yeah.
Because they identify with the Tibetan culture more than maybe their Muslim culture.
Indeed.
So what happens when the movement or the Tibetan identity then is catered towards the Buddhist identity? Would they feel inclusive towards it? Or how can we make it a more open space for them to come and join, especially the Tibetan Muslim youth? So with that perspective, we had written, and I definitely believe that it has changed during the last 4 or 5 years that since we've written the article, it was published. We really feel that our perspectives has changed as well. We know what the hurdles are. We now, because even when we wrote that article, we said it's a very personal perspective. It's not a generalization at all.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's a mixed heritage Tibetan can be an active part of it, and they are. They are an active part of it. So that was our perspective. But definitely it has changed. And we also understand what our faults were and how we can also take an extra effort. But yes, definitely I would love to see, I would rather like to make more efforts in like other Tibetans of different kinds, right? To be actively part of the Tibetan movement, as well as the Tibetan communities that form in different parts of India.
And do you think that the Tibetan mixed heritage group should come back, like should be revived? Because I told you before, like it got shelved to a certain extent, right?
It should, if the goal was then for different identities who might not look Tibetan, right? Because again, when you talk about what is being Tibetan, it looks, you have to look a certain way.
Indeed.
And I think so, I am glad in that way because I look Tibetan in that way because of my facial features. Maybe for a person who has different facial features, for them to be identified as Tibetan would be a very tricky part.
Indeed.
Because of the stereotypes associated with being a Tibetan. Calm, you are a Buddhist, you look a certain way, you dress up a certain way, and you eat certain kinds of food. If this person is very different, I think so then it would really help individuals who might not look but might identify inside themselves as Tibetans. It would really be, I think so, a good initiative for it to come back.
Indeed, and you know, like I also believe we Tibetan from the mainstream should also try to understand your voices and read your literature, because I've been going through some literature on Tibetan Muslims. Very interesting, you know, like its history dates back to the great fifth Dalai Lama, like how he gave a order per se saying what the Tibetan Muslims could do. So very interesting. I think we Tibetans must also, you know, go through such material, understand our own history, which is not, I mean, Buddhism plays a major role, but it is not only Buddhism. We have different things, you know. Tibet as a nation, I mean, many tend to say it was closed, but, you know, one can also argue the other way. Tibet was way open during a certain period. And it's, in some ways, disheartening to see in our Tibetan parliament exile when, you know, a young Tibetan Chitu, a member of parliament, raised a very pertinent question, which you said, like, there might be a time when a non-Buddhist Tibetan might want to be a leader, want to lead the freedom movement. Like, but the counter that she received was very disappointing, in my opinion. Maybe they can also take note of such things and, you know, understand Tibet as a whole.
Yes.
So thank you for sharing with us this very important point. And on top of this, like, you've been growing up in Darjeeling, very interesting place. Like, there was a very interesting interview by Voice of Tibet. I believe you should watch it. I'll recommend after this interview. So what similarities and even differences do you find between the Tibetan and Himalayan people? And does the ancient culture, the social linkages between Tibet and India in the Himalaya, which is called the melting pot by many, play a pivotal role here?
I do feel, and especially the eastern Himalayas, and I feel Kalimpong in this region has like a rich heritage of having linkages to Tibet, as a lot of ambassadors came and stayed out there. Then it has connections to Bhutan as well, to the Sikkimese royalty as well. So Kalimpong, I feel, and us being part of that region, with Kalimpong in the epicenter, plays a really important role. And there are a lot of cultural and religious similarities, because most of them tend to follow Tibetan Buddhism. But I would also say the Himalayan group, ethnic group, it's also very diverse. It's not a homogeneous identity at all. And they come with different cultural practices, different religious practices as well, even though they might be following Buddhism, and as well as different religious identities as well. Because they're in Ladakh, there are a lot of Ladakhi Muslims as well. So from Ladakh to Tawang, I feel you see a varied length of diversity, even within the Himalayan community. But definitely because of the past experiences. And I also feel there is due to the regional similarity, because they belong to that Himalayan belt in itself. From, I think so, because similarities also come from that.
Nangshila, like, you've been researching on minority. So do you find a difference when it comes to, like, how, you know, governments, be it democratic and authoritarian regimes, like the classic example is India and China here. Do you find a difference of how they look into minorities?
I feel there is a difference, but I also feel there is not a difference. So the difference would be the minorities in democratic regimes do tend to have a voice. With whatever, there again might be a lot of ifs and buts and a lot of things, but they do have a voice in a democratic country, right? And like I'm able to share, we are able to record this podcast. It's itself telling of how minorities have a voice, the literal voice in itself, in that way. But in an authoritarian regime, I don't know if the setup was somewhere located in Beijing or in Shanghai, if you would be able to have even His Holiness's portrait or even talk about these issues that we are talking about. So in that sense, it's really very different. But also the not so different part that I highlighted earlier is minorities anywhere around the country, because of the, I'm not sure if it's a numerical minority or a minority where it's been created due to certain majoritarian communities that create. It's always oppressed. Mm-hmm. It's always marginalized in terms of access to education, in terms of access to healthcare, in access to, see, even the media in itself, mm-hmm. even the popular media, the newspapers we read, in any regime itself, I think so there is a form of marginalization and oppression, as well as a hindrance to how they are able to access certain things. So I think so that is what's common between the democratic and the authoritarian. But like I said, there is also the difference in how we are able, the minorities are able to actually have a voice and say in democratic countries.
Indeed, Naisila. And you brought up the thing of how, you know, in an authoritarian regime like China, like bringing up the issue of, or even the mention of the Dalai Lama is like a big no-no. So what is your vision of Tibet as a general, and how do you view the current situation of our fellow Tibetan sisters and brothers in Tibet under Chinese occupation? Because at the end of the day, you know, like we are a minority among Tibetans, you know, population-wise, I'm saying.
Yes,
a larger chunk is there, like more than 90%, if I'm not wrong, is in Tibet. So what's your take on that?
So I really feel, and especially the recent Derge
protests, the
dam protests, have also been telling of both the ecological impact because of the government towards Tibetan communities, as well as the cultural impact, because then it was not just the dam that was being constructed, it meant also relocation, submersion of the monasteries, relocation of these two villages, right, with a lot of Tibetan, with a Tibetan majority, in a Tibetan majority region. So I feel there's, and plus along with a lot of news, we end up reading in news how there's a lot of DNA tests happening, and there is no freedom of speech or freedom to do a lot of things, even to freedom to practice your own religion. Mm-hmm. So the condition, I don't know if it's improving, but at least I feel now there is much more consciousness outside Tibet about what is happening. Mm-hmm. And I think so this is a big part due to the media. I think so phone and the digitalization mm-hmm. has also helped us a lot in that way, that people are just able to take out their phone, record what's yeah. happening, and then send it across, mm-hmm. right? Oh. Even the digital is banned in a lot of ways, right? There is no Facebook, there is no Google that works. And so I really feel that the situation isn't improving from what I see as an outsider.
Yep.
So because, the situation isn't improving, but then what I see is it's better that we are coming to know what's actually happening mm-hmm. so that the larger world is able to know what's actually happening within Tibet, what's the condition of the Tibetans living in Tibet, right? So this is something that I really feel that's there, as well as the fact that for the Tibetans out there struggling, I hope they continue their struggle, because that's the only way forward. And for the larger vision for Tibet, I really hope there is a country that we can call our own someday. I feel to have this, to be a liminal citizen, I think so Sonika Gupta writes in this paper, Liminals, Enduring Liminality. To be a liminal citizen is not forever. It shouldn't be forever for the Tibetan community. And I do hope there is a nation to call our own, like to go back home if you want to, or like that is like, I really hope it happens and it's possible in the future.
Indeed. Very thoughtful words from you, Naisila. And like before we did our podcast, we informally talked about your mother. So an interesting thing you said was she's leading this group in Darjeeling. So mm-hmm. could you expound more on that?
Yes, so because like I said, my grandfather was from Amdo. He was from the Chushi Gandruk, and my mother is part of the Amdukitu. So it works on the issues of, I think community, it forms a community of people who are Amdu by ethnicity, and then works with the issues. I'm not sure if it's in, the Kidus are there in other settlements as well, but I think there is.
Okay, interesting. I think different settlements have their own Kituk, like different groups, and your mom leading the Amdo Kituk in Darjeeling, right?
Yes.
Very interesting, and seeing her daughter doing such amazing work definitely says a lot, you know, like upbringing and everything to a certain extent. So, Nangsala, we are short on time, unfortunately. So, finally, I would like to ask you whether you have any messages to our fellow Tibetans worldwide, and also the plethora of Tibet supporters. You know?
I feel just the message is to continue the struggle from wherever they are, right, for a free Tibet. I think so that's like a message. And for the Tibetan supporters who are not Tibetan or might not be linked directly to the Tibetan cause, I'm really grateful for their support, their continued support that has been able to highlight the Tibetan issue in a lot of platforms. That's my message.
Indeed, Nasila. So this is a perfect time to end it. And no, I would like to read this line. This is a very interesting book. I would recommend you to read it. It's called The Tibetan Caravan. It's about the Western Himalaya, about the Ladakhi Muslims and their connection. Not only Ladakhi Muslims, the Ladakhi people and their connection with Tibet when it was free and independent. So I've not gone through it personally, just read a few pages. But an interesting thing about the author's son, like he's written a foreword. So I think that would be the perfect thing to end it. So let me read it if I have your permission. So he says that Tibetan caravans, in ancient times, Tibetans and, you know, they would do business through such caravans. So he says that Tibetan caravans is a testimony to the organic relationships between societies who have learned how to hear each other out, argue, and even do battle, and yet remain hospitable to each other. So on that note, Nangsala, thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Samir. Thank you. For more updates and videos by FNVA, click on the link and please subscribe to our channel. Thank you for watching.